Hello everybody, this is Pascal Girard's message for Sunday the 18th of August. This morning I will base myself on a text from the Old Testament, two of whose refrains have become famous, which is part of a book whose theme is more or less well known, a book which, along with a few others, has sometimes been ingloriously forgotten in our preaching programmes, when they exist, perhaps because it is not a particularly pious book. There are no beautiful stories, no promises, no warnings. God does not appear in it once to set out his designs or approve of our views, nor to rebuke or even condemn, nor to suggest or even exhort. His author is often considered fatalistic. The text he wrote is often considered negative. You may have already understood which biblical book I am referring to. Yes, it is the book of Ecclesiastes. Today we are going to focus on a section of this book in which the question of happiness is posed as a question about time, time being a notion that seems to reign over everything. Before I begin my reading itself, I must concede something to you. It is that the first two chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes are not the most joyful. The author begins by delivering his famous message, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. And he continues in this way. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 3 to 9. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets, and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north, round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. All is insignificant, all is vanity, or all is smoke, can also be read into other translations, and also all is futile and useless, fleeting and deceptive. This does not really encourage us. But Ecclesiastes observes, examines, meditates on the things he witnesses. It is not a question of living a naive faith where we persuade ourselves that everything is beautiful and going wonderfully. If you see a brother or sister in sadness, do not just throw back this verse that says, "Rejoice always," 1 Thessalonians 5, chapter 16. Because it is fashionable for a Christian to always be joyful. No, that would not be a word of wisdom. But even the most affable among us end up hurting. Side by side in this world you find joy and sadness, wealth and poverty, kindness and wickedness, selfishness and empathy. It has always been this way. What we are experiencing today, others have experienced before us, and others will experience after us. What we are doing today, others have done before us and others will do after us. One generation gives way to another and the earth continues to turn. The winds still blow, the water continues to flow. The sun continues its course in the sky. What is the use of taking the trouble here below? As for our future, in three generations, perhaps four for some, we will no longer be to our families anything but distant relatives of whom we know little, and those who have forgotten us will not remain themselves in the memory of those who will follow. Even more inevitable, unless the Lord returns by then, death will inevitably come one day or another for each of us. This is the fate that all share, all, even the wise with the foolish. So yes, the question of Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 22, deserves to be asked. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labour under the sun? I told you, meaningless, absolutely meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Is that all that can be learned from this text? There is a story about four men walking on a railway track when they arrive at the entrance to a tunnel. The pessimist is taken by the darkness in the tunnel. The optimist sees the arc of light that is drawn over there at the end of the tunnel. The realist wonders how many trains run on this line every day. The poet marvels at knowing that the rails are spaced 1 meter, 43 centimeters and 5 millimeters apart, as if this measure represented a quest for universality, an attempt to unify the whole world and create a common language through identical infrastructures. As for the driver of the train entering the tunnel in the opposite direction, he sees four idiots in the middle of the rails. So this morning, I'm not going to try to look at the situation through the eyes of a pessimist, an optimist, a realist, or even a poet. But I readily admit the first two chapters of the book, which we have reread so far, are quite pessimistic. In fact, the author presents the problem he wants to deal with, which is that of life, before trying to present a solution in chapter 3 of his book by specifying his thinking. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart, that no one can fathom what God has done from the beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. Whatever is has already been, and what will be has been before. And God will call the past to account. What profit does the worker get from the labour he takes? I consider the labours that God has given men to work with. God makes everything beautiful in its time. He has implanted in the depths of man a sense of eternity. But man cannot comprehend the work that God accomplishes from beginning to end. I know that there is nothing good for a man except to rejoice and have a good time during his life. And also that if anyone can eat and drink and enjoy good in the midst of his hard work, it is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does will last forever. Nothing can be added to it or taken from it. And God works in such a way that people fear him. What is now has already been in the past, and what will be in the past has already been in the past. Yes, God brings to pass what is in the past. What provokes this reflection of the preacher? It is the observation established in the first two chapters of his book that there is something absurd about life, that the desperate search for happiness by one's own means is a waste of time when one sees the poor results. It is almost as if through his experience I heard the words of despair spoken by other biblical writers, overwhelmed by life. Jeremiah Chapter 20, verse 14. Cursed be the day I was born. May the day my mother bore me not be blessed. Job chapter 3 verse 3. May the day of my birth perish and the night that said a boy is conceived. But of course we cannot remain in this state of mind. A life filled with happiness, present from the first day to the last, is not a reality in this world. Unhappiness exists, it is a fact. We do not have to deny it, you have known it, each one. And at this moment again, it is very likely that someone here is sad or perhaps dejected. And if you are overwhelmed, you will not be able to return to a more stable state right away, say by simply saying David's words, "My days are in your hand," Psalm 31 verse 16, or the psalmist's words, "This is the day the Lord has made. Let us be glad and rejoice in it." Or by singing, "What will be, Doris Day." So is there such a thing as happiness? Does it still exist? Will it exist regardless? Can you find happiness even if you force it? Or is it simply a matter of making the best of what comes your way? All of us have probably asked ourselves this question in one way or another at some point in our lives. Christians sometimes find happiness harder to come by than people without God. Perhaps we have not really defined the notion of happiness in our life. But the author of the book has formed an opinion. In his own way, he has tried to describe happiness as part of his faith. And he begins with a meditation on the time that resides in everything. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 verse 3. He says, laughing and crying, being born and dying, speaking and being silent, planting and uprooting, loving and hating. There are others, you have heard them. I do not want to examine them one by one. But life is broadly composed of all these contrasts. Anyone who's always laughing seems false. The only way not to die is not to be born. Anyone who spends his time talking ends up being boring. When you hear all this enumeration, you may think that one of the terms is more pleasant, more desirable than the other. In fact, they are complementary. Under the sun, therefore on our earth, you do not have one without the other. Up to war and peace that conclude the list. Yes, only peace existed, it would be paradise. If only war existed, it would be hell on earth. The first will never exist completely. The other should not exist. What matters in life, as Ecclesiastes wants to say, is to do things when it's their turn and then give them the time they need. It is an art that can be learned. Anyone who has raised children knows that you cannot rush things, but that their education takes time. And anyone who is a little further along in life has experienced that some things happen quickly and others slowly, and that it is worth being patient with oneself so that something in oneself can mature. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. The individual search is arduous, but in addition, we live together. And to make matters worse, we even live in time zones, sometimes very different in society when our opinions oppose, in our families when our characters clash. The same thing is experienced in all the communities of churches where the differences can be major. Here we share the same faith in Jesus Christ, Son of God, Saviour. We have in common a certain number of values, and at the same time we are so different from each other. It is a great art to do justice to this and to accept that our differences are not the end of everything. If we succeed, we speak of a fulfilled life. If we do not succeed, we are annihilated, and it is extensible beyond the churches, of course. And it is not easy. Perhaps because there are too many such time zones today, too many clocks in life, too many known or supposedly known conventions, too many hurdles to jump everywhere. We often do things not because they are necessary, but because they are imposed. We lead well-placed, paced lives with little room for pause and little freedom. This is not always a good thing, for example, if work is also supposed to be a vocation. For example, if starting a family is supposed to be something other than the synchronization of two career paths, for example. If listening to one's own body is supposed to be a reality through one's life, and before medical incidents occur, there is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 3. But where, in all this, can one be happy? The answer of Ecclesiastes is this. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11. This means that at every moment we can seek consciously or unconsciously that which no longer needs time, because it can be and remains as it is, which therefore brings us closer to God. Eternity means no longer having to look back or forward, because time stops just as it does for God himself, for whom there is neither beginning nor end. These moments when nothing is lacking, nothing is lost, but when nothing needs to be added, are moments of true happiness for the preacher, which we must seek for our part during our short life. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. Whatever is has already been, and what will be has been before, and God will call the past to account. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. I think we know what he's talking about if we've ever lived through moments like this. For Ecclesiastes, they are proof that God exists, because we in our own strength cannot create moments of happiness and keep them forever. Time is always running out for us one way or another. But what we can aim for is to live our temporal life in such a way that it already contains these moments of eternal happiness. Here we go. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do God good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. When I read verse 13, that a man can eat and drink and enjoy good, I thought I should clarify. Drink, yes, but in moderation. Fortunately, that is not what is important. However, we are in the material realm. It would be wrong to deny it. Let's go back. If you read the first two chapters of the book, of which I have already read you a few verses at the beginning, you will understand that Ecclesiastes, while speaking of the same thing, had a completely different attitude from the one he expresses now. He wrote in substance, I deny myself nothing my eyes desired. I refuse my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labour, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done, and what I had toil to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. But now he approaches the question from a different perspective and sees that seeking to lead a happy life is completely legitimate. Our preacher does not at all encourage consumption and pleasure, for eating, drinking, being merry is just a way of saying, I am not ashamed to seek happiness, since I now understand that happiness too is a gift from God, because God is sovereign over all. He has gone from the uncertainty of life where one counts only on oneself to live a life whose quality is often fluctuating to a life lived under the sovereignty of God, who is the only one with whom we are in security by his grace. It does not matter how old you are, how young you are, what you do or what your favourite means of relaxation are. Sometimes moments of happiness stretch out, but they are never eternal. That is the tragedy, we know it. Ecclesiastes is also painfully aware of this. He who had begun by seeking happiness with great self-confidence, a happiness that had turned out to be so brief, so tenuous, so futile. Drama and tragedy always stand in the way of happiness, such is life. But happiness, when and where it succeeds, is the first fruit of eternity, a foretaste that makes us want more, much more, when what is ephemeral will give way to what is permanent. Happiness when we experience it on this earth and consider it for what it is, that is, a grace from God. It is already a moment when a piece of God's eternity is captured in our lives. Amen.